Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries predominantly in hostile environments. From Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we're living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to The Kemp Cast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future.
Joining me today is British racing hero and occasional villain, Jason Plato. He is a two-time winning BTCC champion, and he also holds the record for the most overall race wins in the competition. He is quite a character. I hope you enjoy the show. Jason Plato, thank you for joining us.
Oh, mate, you're welcome. It's good to be here. How are you?
Mate, clearly you're not going to plug your book, are you?
No.
How not to be a professional racing driver. I mean, I'm going to do a quote straight away. I drink and I smoke and I shouldn't. My mantra has always been, if you're going to get wet, you may as well go swimming. So is that basically go hard or go home?
Yeah, I suppose you could say that. I mean, I've always kind of been that way. You know, even at school when I was a kid, if I did anything, I did it, you know, 100%. Whether that was good things or bad things. Or, you know, it's just, you know, if you're going to do something, then execute and do it to the best you possibly can, regardless of whatever it is. And sometimes that bites you and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, that's kind of, I mean, that is my mantra. You know, if you are going to get wet, then why not go swimming?
And then has that been your mentality, as you say, when you've raced?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my kind of racing character, if you like, was born out of, you know, I started racing when I was 11 years old in karting. And prior to that, you know, my heroes were James Hunt, Gilles Villeneuve. Probably Gilles was the one person actually which really inspired me. And the way he went about his, you know, his racing, he wanted to win at all costs. And, you know, second place was first loser. And he would just give everything. And I love that kind of style. And, you know, I was always taught by my mum and dad that, you know, neither of us agree. And I try to instill this into my kids as well, that, you know, there's that expression, you know, it's not the winning that counts, it's the taking part. Well, that's utter bullshit in my book. You know, if you do something and it's competitive, you do it to win, and you must be upset when you lose. And that's kind of stayed with me all the way through both my, you know, my racing career, my TV career and business, and, you know, that kind of attitude.
So that's something that was instilled in you, do you think, by your dad? I mean, here's a question for you. Do you think, and your dad owned a garage up in the Northeast, and I love the bit about, you know, the teachers excited about what car your dad was going to turn up and drop you off at school to play. But, you know, had your dad not received that go-kart, racing go-kart, capable of 100 miles an hour, as part of a bad debt, do you think you would have ended up where you are?
That's a really good question. I think probably yes, actually, because we would have found, you know, we would have found karting. So yeah, I do think I would have done, because, you know, I can remember going to the 1976 British Grand Prix with my dad. I can remember, you know, sat on his lap watching the Bathurst 1000 as a kid. So motor racing and the love of it was very much a Plato family thing. So yeah, I'd like to think we would have found, you know, motorsport in some way or another. Yeah.
And how important to this day is that relationship between your mum and your dad?
Massively important. You know, I'm a very lucky lad, actually, in that, you know, they're still together. They're still my buddies. You know, I can remember, and it was when I first got my big break in 97, where I became a professional driver, if you like. And as a thank you for the endless support and remortgaging houses, which they'd done, and missed holidays and all those sorts of sacrifices made, I bought them a really luxury VIP 2 weeks in the Seychelles. And I remember, you know, I had a little envelope with with all the tickets in. I gave it to my mum and dad, and she looked at it and then said, "Well, we can't go because it's Knock Hill race weekend." And guess what? I had to change it. And they've probably only missed maybe three or four races in all that time. I mean, they even pitched up in Australia. I didn't know they were going to turn up, and I was walking down the pit lane on a Thursday, and there they were. You know, they love it. Absolutely love it, which is great.
It became an obsession for them, as it did for you.
Without a doubt. I mean, you know, from the very early days, from, you know, age 11, 12 onwards, you know, my mum's dining room and her sideboard and her dresser in the dining room became our workshop. I mean, there was engines on the sideboard. And, you know, there's a constant smell of fuel and oil in the house. But that's how we rolled. You know, we loved it. And the other interesting thing about karting was, we you know, that's not unique. Everybody that does karting at a competitive level from an early age, all the mums and dads are like that. So, you know, we every weekend, we'd be, you know, we could be in Somerset one weekend, back up to Yorkshire the next weekend, racing almost every weekend. And there'd be this travelling little circus of all these same five families. And we're all like kindred spirits because we all did the same stuff. You know, everybody made sacrifices. You know, mum was the team doctor, team cook. Dad was the engineer, the mechanic. You know, our dog used to come along to all the races. That's just how it rolled. And it's, you know, looking back, it was really special, actually. Really special.
You say about your mum, she took no shot from anyone. Was she also a bit of a negotiator on your behalf?
She was definitely a very good mediator, I would say, between, you know, when tempers got flared between me and my dad. You know, about, you know, maybe I messed up or crashed or did something wrong. You know, it was quite tense. And the competitive spirit is equally strong for both of us. Often she'd be in the middle trying to calm it down.
And there again, Jason, that I will not lose, I will win at any cost. Do you think that's inherited then?
Yeah, I think it probably is, actually. I think it probably is. I think there's a mindset. You know, my dad's intensely competitive in everything. So yeah, I think it probably is. You know, but then again, you know, my mum, while she's, you know, she's delightful, she's lovely, everybody loves her, But it, you know, you'd be foolish to think she was a soft touch, because actually underneath all that, oh, she's a strong, feisty lady. So I think actually a bit of both. So I do think it is. I do think that sort of character, you're born with it. Yeah, there's great examples over the years of racing drivers of, the caliber and the natural talent as, say, Michael Schumacher versus Damon Hill. And Damon's a good pal of mine, and he won't mind me expressing this opinion, and that is that Michael was born with an insane amount of natural ability. And Damon, not quite as much, but Damon, through application and focus and joining all the pieces together, became world champion and beat Michael. But I think the difference was Michael could drive a car with 50% of his brain, or his bandwidth being used only 50%, and the rest he could think about strategy and all the other things, where Damon was using all of his. So I do think you are born with, you know, traits, characters, and I think, you know, mine served me well in motorsport, I think.
Well, it does. The facts bear that out. You've had 599 starts. Well, these are the stats I've got. You've had 97 wins. So that averages out to, like, in every race that you took part in, you won 1 in 6, which is a record, is a world record, right?
Yeah, it is.
So if no one else has beaten that, and it doesn't look, do you reckon anyone will ever beat that kind of record?
Maybe. I mean, you know, we can cast our mind back, say, 6 or 7, 8 years, and you would say that Michael Schumacher's record in Formula One was completely untouchable. and now, you know, the amazing driver that Lewis Hamilton is, he's going to eclipse that. So of course it's possible. It'll take some doing, but one thing for sure is if anyone does beat it, then they deserve it.
Well, exactly. But also the thing is that certain Formula One drivers will be associated with a certain team that produce an impeccable car. You have moved around a bit, haven't you? You can't blame. You can't say, that Jason, he was a bit lucky because he was just in with Mercedes at the right time, or in with Ferrari or McLaren.
Yeah.
Can you actually remember how many teams you've raced for?
Let's have a look. Renault, Vauxhall, Seat, Chevrolet. probably eight or so teams. But you know, that's a career which has been non-stop, really, apart from 2 years since 1997. But, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of, rather than just the number, you know, the number of wins, but one of the things I'm most proud of is, you know, I've won with every body that I've worked with. And I've generally been able to turn a good car or to turn a car where it'll be good, bad or indifferent into a good car and then into a winning car. And, I'm really proud of that. Really proud.
Tell me about the relationship between a driver and a car. Do you know the minute you sit in that car, we've got to work on this? The moment you sit down, do you know what, you and I, this is a love affair, this is a match made in heaven. Can you tell immediately? Does it come on the first bend? How do you get, what is it about a car that you instantly recognise as being good or bad?
Well, firstly, you do know, straight away. And that knowledge, you learn that over the years. So the more you the more experienced you are, the more you can spot that really great feeling you have in a car, or the potential that is in the car. You can feel that more easily, if you like. But you know, probably the most important thing is, you know, that it's not just the car and me. There's a link between the two. And that is, you know, your race engineer. And he's the guy who really understands the engineering and the technical aspects of the car. But also he's the guy which really understands what I want from it. So he's kind of like the interpreter. He can, you know, understand what I need to make me go faster. What I need to make me not only go faster, but look after the tires and all these other things. He's the person who can decipher that and think, right, okay, let's change this on the car. And the changes we make are minuscule. You know, a 2 or 3 millimeter increase in rear ride height can completely change the feel of the car. Completely. And there's 101 other things we can do. And that's one of the really interesting and fun parts, actually, which is learning to work with the engineer to tune the car. Because it's not just one thing you change. You'll need to change maybe 3 or 4 things together to make that one thing that you're trying to find improve. So, you know, let's say you've got too much mid-corner understeer at, say, corners 1, 4, and 5. And corners 4 and 5 are the really important corners. You might have to mess up the settings so that corners 2 and 7 are slightly detuned, but then you make the gains in the crucial corner. So everything's a compromise. And of course, you know, the temperature goes up 1 degree, track temperature, car changes again. So you're constantly tickling the thing. And that's really great. That's really enjoyable. Can be quite frustrating if you go down a wrong rabbit hole, because it can take a while to get back out of the thing. But yeah, the detail and the feel that you need to get the car right on the edge is amazing, actually, because we're trying to find, you know, tenths, half a tenth per second. You know, that can be the difference between pole position or sixth.
Let's talk about what it's like sitting in that car on the grid. Let's talk about you and what goes through your head.
This is quite interesting, because this is something which from my very early days I've worked on and tried to refine to improve my performance. In the early days, I would most certainly go into the zone, wind myself up, lock myself away in my thoughts. And I found that the result was, you know, when the lights went out and races on, I was a bit too fired up. I was a bit too punchy. And that would sometimes make me a bit over aggressive in the opening laps. Whilst you do need some aggression, I just found that if I wound myself up too much, then I was a bit too punchy. And over the years, I've actually gone the other way now. And I found that by not allowing myself to get caught up in the moment and to have a crack on the radio with the engineers and the mechanics and to keep them up and buoyant and just have a giggle to try and almost tune myself away from what's about to happen. And that worked for me, because as soon as the door shut and it was time to go out on your parade lap, the lap where you come to the grid, that was enough time for me to activate myself and to turn on.
So basically you're over-adrenalizing yourself when you locked yourself into yourself, yeah?
Absolutely, absolutely. And everybody's different. You know, I see other drivers have a very different routine to me. Some, I guess, are like me. But I think in that crucial moment, it's exactly that. You do over-adrenalize yourself.
I mean, for people who don't understand the British touring cars, just give us an idea of how powerful they are.
Well, do you know what? Stats alone, in the modern day, they're not that spectacular if you just read a piece of paper. Yeah, they've got 400 horsepower, majority are front-wheel drive. They're all saloon car-based. They kind of look like the car you can buy on a Monday. But underneath the shell, everything's gone. It doesn't resemble the road car at all. It's basically a racing car built within a road car shell. They're 2 litre, quite heavily restricted in terms of what you can do to the car to try and make the racing as close and as even as possible. Yeah, we have things like success ballast, so you do well, they make your car heavier, and that's to try and equalize the grid so that the racing's close, intense, and
so they put weights. That was one thing I did a little bit of racing working with the team for Jordan, right. Eddie. They put planks of wood under Formula One cars.
Yes.
What's the... They're trying to make it the fastest thing to go around the track, and all of a sudden, now you're going a bit too fast, we'll throw some wood under your car. I mean, yeah. So they penalise you if you're too quick to make sure that it's a fair competition, which goes totally against winning, which is what you're all about. they add weight to your vehicle. Is that right?
Yes, and they can, you know, and it has been...
The handicap, like the handicap horse.
Absolutely, exactly like a handicap. But also, it wasn't that long ago where you'd do well. Not only would they put weight on, but they'd turn your engine down as well. So you'd have less power than... And this has caused lots of controversy. You know, I was one of the most outspoken about that nonsensical idea that, you know, go slow, get more power. Really? Anyway, but in the round, it works because it makes it very close. You know, the weights change on each race. So if you win the first race... let's say you're leading the chat championship, you get to the next race. For qualifying, you have to put 50 kilos of lead in your car and carry that for the first race. And then the finishing order of the first race determines, A, your start position for race two, but, of course, then all the weights reset. And then just to throw a curveball in, the third race of the day is a reverse grid draw. So, you know, let's say you win race two, you can start 10th for race one, for race three. So it mixes it up. Which is great because it means you've got to learn to race and you've got to...
You've got the fastest car. You can't guarantee a pole, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why it's such an interesting game. And that's why it's, you know, arguably I should have had another 4 championship wins. Without a doubt, 2 of those are just bad luck. Car broke when I was leading, all that sort of stuff. But probably another 2 championship losses, if you like, where I've come first loser, was me wanting to win every single race and not settling for a third or not settling for a fourth and playing the long game, because that's not the way I'm made up.
That strategy would have probably won you the championship overall.
Absolutely. I'm not programmed to play the percentages that I'll fall, so all right. No, if the wind's on, I won't have it. And that's why I've won almost double the amount of races of anybody else in history of BTCC, and only 2 championship wins. I mean, I should have had 6, but hey-ho.
One thing, Jason, obviously the Touring Car Championships reflect the cars that mere mortals like myself can go and buy.
Yeah.
More and more cars are becoming electric. Do you foresee a time when the Touring Car Championships will be electric?
That's an interesting question. Do you know what? Until recently, I was... I'm not into the electric game at all until recently, but I've changed my mind, actually. And I think there will become a time, and it's a sensible idea, where we will all be driving some sort of zero-emission car, whether it be electric or hydrogen fuel cell or whatever. And the current offerings of electric cars, you know, if you look at what Tesla are doing with and then if you look at what Porsche are doing with the Taycan, I mean, they're amazing bits of kit that those guys have got. But I think there will always be a place for internal combustion engine motorsport, always. I think and there are now electric only motorsport. You've got Formula E, which is a little single seater, a bit like a Formula 3 car, which is a global series. You've now got E Extreme, which is coming in a year and a half's time, which is a bit like a rally raid, but electric only. And also, there is going to be a touring car series in Europe, which is for electric vehicles. And I think both can live alongside each other. I mean, in the British Touring Car Championship, in 2022, there's a regulation change where we have to run an electric motor as well as the internal combustion engine, which will give us about 60 horsepower on a button, and that'll add a bit of strategy, you know, some greenish credentials. But I think both should exist, and I think it'd be a very sad day if we never hear proper racing car engines. Very sad day. I mean, everyone should drive a V8. End of. Ban electric cars.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A couple of questions. One thing I say is, you know, the love and the diligence and just the dedication your parents gave to you in terms of traveling you around, finding that car and becoming totally part of your future is fantastic. Is that option open to most kids? Can any kid born without dad who's got a garage, can they make it a motorsport?
It's very difficult. And even more so now than it was in my day. I mean, so much more difficult now. And
why, Jason?
It's just cost prohibitive. I mean, you know, motor racing is very expensive, even at a karting level. You know, yes, you can go and buy a kart for, you know, racing kart and a few bits and bobs for a few grand. But once you want to start racing properly and you get involved in a championship and you want to be competitive, you know, nowadays, you know, kids are starting at eight, nine years old. And by the time they're at the age I was when I started, say 11, 12, if you want to be competing at a national level and winning, it's 100 grand.
A year?
Yes. If you want to compete internationally, it's $250,000 to, you know, that's to be in with the best team and have the best equipment. Well, let's just go back to 100 grand. That's not 100 grand because that's net. You've got to pay tax before you can get that 100 grand. So actually,
it's 200 grand.
And then, so what have you got left for housing, education, food? It's so expensive.
And the margins are so slim, you could be quite good. You could be very, very good. But if you're not in that half of the 1%, that was a dream that not only ended in tears, it also broke you.
Absolutely. And there are so many examples of, you know, some great contemporaries of mine when I was, you know, before I got my big break. I mean, some really very, very stylish, good racing drivers, very gifted, and nowhere to be seen because they just ran out of cash. And that's such a shame. But, you know, I guess you can say that about all sorts of things. You know, it's very hard to get to the top in anything. But the one thing with motorsport is it's so expensive and you cannot win in a crap car.
And it also makes it, sorry as I say this, but it's slightly elitist, isn't it? It is elitist. Not slightly, it's elitist.
But, and, you know, talking about Lewis, you know, Lewis's dad, when they first started karting, had like 3 or 4 jobs and more just to pay for it. But if it wasn't for Ron Dennis from McLaren spotting Lewis at a very early age and becoming his financier, we wouldn't have Lewis Hamilton had it not been for Ron. And so, you know, there might be up the road in Tesco, stacking shelves, the best racing driver in the world. We'll never see him.
Does that annoy you?
It doesn't annoy me, but I just, you know, I see lots of areas where motorsport could actually reduce costs, but it never does. It only ends up getting more expensive and lots, you know. Although what I will say is British touring cars, when I got involved, was kind of like what was called the super touring car heyday, where there was 8 or 9 manufacturers. Every driver on the grid was a professional driver. Most were Europeans. everyone was getting paid. The budgets were enormous. You know, the annual budget at Williams, excluding driver salaries, excluding engines, was circa 10 million quid. And touring cars has done a brilliant job of evolving to drive those costs down. So touring cars is a great example, actually. It can be done. And a budget now is about £1 million to run a car properly. Well, that's a huge reduction, but it's still £1 million.
But then again, let's talk about Formula One very quickly. I mean, Lewis basic is around 40 million. Yeah. So he could run 40 teams, should he feel like it. You know, if you do make it in motorsport, you make it forever, don't you?
For the very good guys, yes. You know, and there's about, I would say there's three or four tiers of quality in terms of drivers in F1. You know, you've got Lewis, Vettel, although he's kind of come off the bubble a little bit now. You know, you've had Schumacher, you've had Senna, you've had Alonso. You know, these guys are really very, very special. Then you've got the next tier down, which is still very, very, very good, but just not quite that last little bit. And then you've got kind of the average driver, let's call him that, in Formula One terms. And then you've got the lad who's got a rich dad.
And that's the case, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
what about you then? What about you? Because there you are, you're karting, you're doing really well, you win a championship. What was it about you that didn't fit with F1, or F1 didn't fit with you?
That's a good question. Back in the day when I was going through my single-seater junior formula, so Formula Renault, and then went to Formula 3, you know, on kind of performance alone, you know, I was tipped as a star of the future for Formula 1. But we ran out of money at a very crucial time. We got into Formula 3 and didn't really have the funds, you know, ducked and dived and made promises and ultimately then couldn't come up with the funds. And my shot at F1 vanished, because once a snowball has gone off course, it's very difficult to get it back on. And also there wasn't, back in those days, there wasn't very many kind of like scholarship junior programs like there is now with Red Bull and Ferrari. There wasn't those. There was one, which was the Marlborough program. And amusingly, or ironically, probably being the only smoker of my era, I was never picked up on the Marlborough program. But I think one of the reasons was, back in those days, you had to be squeaky clean and not mavericky, and you know, got to play the game, not be too outspoken. Of course, that wasn't me, and you know, I probably rubbed a few people up the wrong way.
But you also make a point that also, even when you've been teaching people how to drive and you're looking at up and coming proteges, etc., you've got to be more than just quick, particularly in touring cars. You've got to have a personality, and I mean, you moulded yourself, as you say. I mean, it's Dick Dastardly, isn't it? I mean, and I know a bit of you, Jason, and I know that you're a charming, wonderful chap to be around, apart from when you're playing tricks on people. But is that you, or is that you playing a role? Is that you playing a role as part of the sponsorship deals? Because sponsorship is massively important. You know, your name is more famous than most touring car drivers. That's partly because of the way that you drive, but it's also partly because of your larger than life persona, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I learned a really valuable lesson early on in my career, and that was before I got my big break with Williams. My single seater career dried up. I wasn't racing. I didn't have any budget. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I gave it one last push. And I was working as a racing instructor at Silverstone, and one of the rules were, you don't approach corporate clients. Anyway, I did, and I got a great deal, and I landed a sponsor in Swan National Leasing. Anyway, started to to look at getting my single seater career back online. And my friends at Renault UK, who I, you know, raced in my formative years with in Formula Renault, they got on the phone and said, look, we're launching a new one make series. You should be in this. And my initial reaction was, no, I can't do one make series. You know, if I go, there's no way I could win in terms of if I go in and win, which I should do, everyone will go, well, he should do. And if I, you know, if I don't win for whatever reason, then that's me burnt. I'm dead. Anyway, they turned around and they said, you should think about it because the winner of the series gets a test with Williams Renault in their touring car at the end of the year. And we know that Will Hoy, God bless him, was one of the drivers at Williams, was retiring or was leaving the team out of contract at the end of that year. So I thought, right, there's a chance. Anyway, won the championship, did the test with Williams, did a great job, was fast, all those sorts of things. And then went for an interview with Frank and very shortly afterwards got a letter from Frank saying, look, thanks. There's no drive for you. And you know, please don't be disheartened because actually there was never a drive for you because we need someone with profile. You can do the job, but we're going to go for an X4 Formula 1 driver or something like that. And do you know what? That really hurt. But it was a great lesson because it proved to me that actually, yes, doing the right thing in the car is important, but actually that hasn't got me the drive. What lost me the drive was having no profile. But then I started to really think about that. So in answer to your question, have I egged it up? To a certain degree, yes, but I saw there was more notoriety and by being honest, I playing myself as a bit of a maverick and being a bit outspoken and wearing stuff on my sleeve and not being, you know, not being a homogenized version of myself, just being a bit raw would serve me well. And do you know what? It has. Okay. It's caused some issues along the way, obviously, but it works very well.
It clearly has, as you can say. Well, look, let's face it, both of us are post 50 and we've both been around for a bit now. I don't remember ever, though, stealing a JCB on the Monaco racetrack.
Well, I didn't. I didn't steal it. I just borrowed it for a few seconds and started it up. But, yeah, that wasn't a great moment. I mean, funny now to look back, but... You know, I was walking back from the boozer with a couple of pals, and because, you know, no one locks anything up in Monaco. The keys were in it, and I thought, hey, I've never driven a JCB. So I turned on, started to move forward, was moving the arm around, and the next thing, the gendarmes had me out and locked up in Nick.
Did they see any of the funny side of it, or were you...
You know, they were okay. They were fine. I mean, I did say, look, there's no point locking me up here because my apartment said, he went, no, you don't understand. You're nicked. You need to sleep in the cell for the night. And then the amazing thing is, it's all quite nice, actually. You know, they bring you some coffee and a croissant in the morning. But then they said, I said, well, look, yeah, I've served my time. Can I go? And he brought a breathalyzer in. I said, no. He said, no, you can leave here when it's zero.
And what time did you actually leave then?
2 o'clock. But and then the funny thing is you then get an invoice. You get a bill.
What, for the croissant and the coffee?
Well, you're bored in lodgings overnight. You get a bill. It was like 60 euros or something.
But again, that's something about you. That's you being very honest and being straight about the fact that you like a drink and you like cigarette and you go out and you have fun. And that's not something that we often see from many racing drivers. Again, it's about this automatron that is totally focused on one thing, and that's going faster than anybody else, which you still have. But you've also created a larger-than-life character around that, which is genuinely you are the man that sticks fireworks to the side of people's caravans while they're fire to them, aren't you? You're still mates with James Martin, considering I saw the burns at the side of the vehicle.
Yes, well, yeah. It was...
What time in the morning was that?
He'd gone to bed early. He'd gone to bed early, and
like 2 o'clock, something like that.
Oh yeah, it's ridiculous. Ridiculously early. Yeah, well, it was me and Adrian Newey, actually, who got ourselves into a firework fetish.
Mate, look, you're not racing this season. You're putting it on hold, yeah, from what I read and what I understand. You're determined you're going to go back next season, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was a very difficult choice to do what we have done. And that is, you know, obviously with the lockdown and this terrible virus, everything stopped. And it was very early on. I remember, you know, we did the media day back in March, and it was just starting to get a hold, and it was just... It didn't feel right, and I was concerned. So the championship was postponed, and the plan was they were going to start again in August. But there was only going to be 9 events rather than 10. Corporate hospitality was forbidden. So straight away, the sponsors are going to be served something less than what they paid for. Oh, this was my thought process. So I thought, well, hold on. And let's just imagine we get going and then let's say one of the team members gets the virus. So we then can't compete. Sponsor then is more disappointed. And then it ends in November. At best, they're going to be disappointed. At worst, they're going to be really upset. What are the chances of them then coughing up or investing for a further season next year? And when I added all this up, I just thought, you know what? It's too risky. Too risky to shortchange sponsors, and they're very, very hard to get. So we spoke to them all and they said, do you know what? That's a great, great idea. Let's just let's get the contracts, cross the zero out and turn it from 2020 to 2021. So everybody's deals are still in play. We're there ready for next year. And you know what? You know, my motor racing, you know, it ends in each year, ends mid or October. We then do a couple of tests to, at the end of the year, just to kind of round off the year. So some of the things we learned but couldn't really test. And then it stops until February, it starts again. So you've got those cold winter months to wind yourself up, to get yourself really focused and ready. Of course, that didn't happen. And I got to June, and whilst, you know, once we'd taken the decision in end of March, April to stop, I was still kind of regretting it, thinking, oh, we've done the right thing. Once I got to June, I'm like, mate, this is such the right thing to do, because I wasn't in the right frame of mind. You know, the thought of going racing next weekend doesn't sex me up now, because I've not gone through the process of getting in the groove. So actually, I've not been to any of the races this year. I've not
watched, you not watched any, and if you did, you think it would wind you up?
I've not watched anything. I followed a little bit on social media just to say congrats to winners and all that sort of stuff, but I'm just not interested. You know, my mind is next year. Also, you know, lockdown's been, you know, hey, I can't complain at all because I'm a very lucky guy. You know, we live in a nice place in Oxford. We've got a garden. We've got a bit of money in the bank, yada, yada, yada. It's been bloody awful for millions and millions of people. And I just felt it would be wrong to go out and put my hands in the air and go, yeah, we've won during this awful time. And also the thought process of being away now when trying to get kids back to school, you know, we've just moved house. Me being in that motor racing zone probably would have led to divorce.
Look, you're not getting any younger, and neither am I. But, you know, I don't race a car around a track as fast as I possibly can. And if I don't do it that quick, I don't get a gig the next year. That's an immense amount of pressure to put on anyone. But particularly as you get older, because people are going to go, oh, he's getting slower because he's getting older. And all the pressure that then heaps on you, then transfers into your personal life. You've got to juggle that as well. So it's been a very difficult time with COVID, but it may have been a bit difficult time without it. How do you deal with that, the pressure? Because literally, you're as good as your last job, quite literally. But you're also probably risking your health, and you have been hurt in the past with vehicles. You're risking your personal health. You're risking your future livelihood if you don't do the best you could possibly do and have a run of luck, because luck plays a part of it. But all that pressure comes back home, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've had many a discussion with Soph where, you know, over the years, Soph has turned around and said, look, you know, you're here, but you're not present. And I'm like, what are you on about? And whilst motor racing is, you know, we race on the weekends, it consumes me and I'm consumed by it and I'm focused 24 hours a day on the thing. And actually, it's been quite eye-opener, actually, this whole process of letting it go for a year. Because actually, I've learned an awful lot about some of my failings at home and how tricky I can be at times and how focused and...
I don't think you're the only parent that's done that. But yeah, carry on. Give me some examples.
I'm not consumed by it. And one of the interesting things you mentioned about the age thing is a few years ago, I basically created the Subaru Works program in the British Touring Car Championship, got that deal, took it to a race team. My engineer basically designed the car. And this was of an idea me and a guy called Carl Foe, who is my longtime race engineer, had in 2012 in a pub over lunch where we were looking at these new regulations which were coming in, and we decided, do you know what? There's a loop here, there's a hole, and if we can get a package, a Subaru Boxster engine in rear-wheel drive, it's going to be a world beater. The problem is we just signed a three-year deal with another manufacturer. So whilst we had all these ideas, we then had to quickly bury them all and just keep our fingers crossed that no one else had these thoughts. Well, catapult forward 4 years, no one did. So we created this deal. And it was amazing. It was groundbreaking. The car was stunning. And, in my first year with the car, and this was now going back to rear wheel drive, which I've not raced for many, many years. It's fair to say I wasn't quite on the ball. And my teammate was, you know, regarded as the best rear wheel drive touring car driver around, a guy called Colin Turkington. And at the beginning of the year, he was a bit quicker than me. But towards the end, we were nip and tuck. And then something weird happened. Then a very, you know, a precocious talent, brilliant young driver, got replaced Colin, and his manager owned the team, or his the team owner also was his manager, and it just got a bit odd. I had my car stopped working the way it should do, and my performance just went off a cliff, and it was, you know. My engineer was taken away from me, and I'd never been in that situation before. And I know what was going on, but that was the first time I'd ever been uncompetitive in my life. But it was also when I turned 50. And of course, it now inbound comes the flak from social media, fans, competitors, the industry. And I'm like, no, it's not that. It's not. But it was a very, very, very difficult time. But interesting enough, you know, I learned a lot from that experience, because actually when it all went wrong, and I went, enough, and I walked.
So this is when you end up in the back of the grid for the first time in your professional career. Is that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely, yeah. First time ever. Since ever putting a steering wheel in my hand.
Since you were put in a car.
Yeah, I mean, it's never happened before. This was it. And it was like week in, week out. And I'm like, this is not right. And what's more is, I know deep down inside, it's not me. I know that. So I'll tell you what was really great was, you know, at the end of a couple of years ago, at the end of that season, I literally that was it. I'd had enough. Thrown the towel in. I'm like, that's it. I think I'm done. Actually, I think I'm done.
What would you have done at that point had you not gone back to touring cars?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Probably more TV and a bit of business and. But interesting enough, goes back to what I was saying about, you know, me being present, but not present in the room at home. You know, during that period, it was pretty awful. You know, I was stressed. I was wound up. and it was 24/7. And nevertheless, I lost the ability to take any kind of warning signs or feelings from my family, because I was so consumed with this shit situation I was in and how could I get out of it. Anyway, I then got a new deal with a new team, went out first race, bang, front row, I'm back. But that whole process was a very important lesson to me, in that I was totally unaware, just the damage that I was doing to my personal relationships with my kids, with me and my wife, Sophie. And fortunately, you know, I recognized it soon enough that I could change it. And now I'm very aware of making sure that I'm not just in the room, but I leave my motor racing at the front door. Or if I need to conduct some business at home, I go into an office or a study and don't, you know, walk around my open plan barn on the phone, oozing stress and winding everyone up. So that whole process has been really interesting, which has also made this whole lockdown thing really interesting. You know, whilst it's been bloody awful, I've actually really enjoyed it in many ways. I'm bored now, I'm frustrated now. But early doors, it was quite refreshing, actually, to spend more time with my wife.
It helps, Jason. You're not the only one that's been accused of not being present. That happens in the Kemp household as well.
Well, you know,
generally around mealtime, when there's no TV on, the kids are eating their food, we're having a conversation, and I am thinking, I need to go and talk to that person about that job, because if that doesn't happen, then this won't happen, and if that doesn't happen, then this can't happen. And that's human nature. But I have also, under lockdown, reevaluated my relationship, and you're not the only one, sir. But, you know, you're back now, Justin, right? You know, you're taking this year out, and you're going to come back. It has to end at some point, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yes, it does. You know, one thing for certain is, you know, each year I do get older. I'm 52. And, you know, there will become a time when, you know, I'll probably lose a couple of tenths of a second. I don't know, because that hasn't happened. But at some point it's going to happen. But I think what will probably happen before then is I will, you know, the absolute burning desire to get up in the morning and go motor racing, that will diminish slightly. And once that happens, then I'll know that's enough.
And what about the kind of the thing, people say this to me about taking risks and having a family and getting older. And I use the analogy of something like this. If you're going to tackle someone, if you go in thinking you're going to get hurt, you're going to get hurt. You know, the mentality of doing what you do, you have to go, as you say, you may leave it at the door, but you've got to make sure you pick it up when you leave that door, right?
Yeah. And you know, an interesting thing there was when, you know, was the birth of my kids. You know, quite a few people said, does that affected you, what you like on the car, on the track, when now you've got some children? And actually, it reinforced what was like on the track. Interesting enough, it made me a bit slower on the roads. So you know, I take less risks now, non-motor racing risks, than I ever did. But once, you know, it's like I was saying earlier, once the helmet goes on, the door gets shut, and it all fires up, then the switch gets flicked, and you switch into the racing driver mode, and that is almost trance-like.
So if the older Jason was talking to the younger Jason now, would it be you need to flick that switch off a few times before you just leave it on all the time?
I think that's probably fair to say, yeah. Yeah.
Mate, you've had a few, let's talk about, because there's one thing I want to talk to you about is Bernie Eccleston, right?
Right.
Because I used to live in Battersea and used to go up to the shops, not to buy clothes, buy food and stuff like that, and get a coffee. Couldn't afford to buy clothes up there. And I looked rather daft in them anyway. But you used to see Bernie Eccleston walking up and down the King's Road,
yeah,
carrying a Waitrose bag on a regular basis. He's quite a distinguished gentleman anyway, and a very wealthy and very important man that he is. Why did you nearly kill him?
I mean, it's right at the beginning of my touring car career with Williams Renault. And it was literally my first year And I was like the new puppy. Anything I could do, I'll do that. PR, oh yeah, I'll do that. So I'm doing everything. So nearly every day I'm at an Elf petrol station, I'm off to Renault, I'm doing stuff. And I was loving every minute of it. Anyway, I was at a gig on Saturday night in London, an awards due, which I was then representing Renault, I had to collect an award for them or something like that. And then obviously went out, had a bit of fun. And then the following day, I had to go down to Ringwood. I'm sure it was Ringwood or Southampton to go and do some stuff at a Renault dealership. So I'm leaving a bit early. I'm slightly jaded from the night before, just tired. But I'm in all in my kit, you know, my branding, my team kit. And I'm driving down the King's Road in my British Racing Green Renault Laguna V6. And I'm tuning something on the radio or, you know, trying to get some, you know, a station. And actually I look up and Bernie's on the zebra crossing. And I jump, I'm nearly through the winch key. And I stopped like that far away from him. And he's turned around, looked at me, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's Bernie. But had I gone for one more station, I would have taken him out. Because I was doing 40, say, I would have killed him.
Do you think that had anything to do with your F1 career?
No, not at all. But could you imagine what would have happened?
No, mate. Well, it would have been the end of the sponsorship deal, I guess. Let's talk about the cars that you've had, mate. Because I love this. Because this is, the VW Beetle was the car that
I bought. Two of the buggers I had.
I bought off my granddad. My granddad was in the Remy during the Second World War, fought all the way through North Africa and recovered tanks off battlefields up into Italy. But that VW Beetle, even though it was from Deutsche, was the love of his life. It was immaculate. It even had like a protection, like a stone guard over the front of the bonnet that was checkered. And he kept... And I love that car. And I had that car. And we still have a Beetle in the family. Peugeot 205.
Yeah. It's a 205 GTI 1.9 Belter.
1.9, beautiful. Remember there, you had the 1.9. You had a 1.6, but you had a 1.9. And they had it on the side of the window,
yeah,
didn't
you? Yeah. On the seat. So,
the Peugeot 205 to drive or the Integrale, the Delta, that was a beautiful car. I mean, it had the flared arches, didn't it?
Yeah, and the two little round four little
headlights. Yeah,
I mean,
that was a
sexy car. I mean, it was that car was mental. I mean, amazingly, brilliant car. I mean, it died. I killed it. I didn't have it that long, yeah. But the GTI was that was ace. But yeah, the death of the Integrale was a very, very Christ Almighty. It was a life changing moment. That was.
But you've had Ferraris, you've had Porsches. Any particular favourite?
Do you know what? Over the years, I've had lots of Porsches, and that's my brand. That's for me. The 911 is the best road car in the world, bar none. And if you
bar none,
yeah. I mean, because you can use it, it's a supercar you can use every day. I mean, you know, I've had quite a few Turbo S's and just recently got rid of a really special Turbo S. And there is nothing faster from A to B with one eye closed, with one hand on the steering wheel. There is nothing faster. And I mean, they are rocket ships, but they're comfy. They're quiet. Everything works. They don't drink fuel. I mean, I used to get 28 to the gallon, which sounds hideous, but it's got 600 horsepower. Fantastic things. And the other thing is, people don't hate you in them. If you drive a red Ferrari and drive it through London, I mean, I've had my car spat on just through driving it. A lot of people detest you in Ferraris or Lamborghinis. In a Porsche, no one cares because they all kind of look the same. And there's lots of them around. And you would, unless you were a car enthusiast, you wouldn't know the difference between one that's, say, 40 grand and one that's, say, 200 grand.
And so it's the people's car, but it's also the people's supercar.
Yeah. So I'd say that, you know, that's for a car that I've owned and lived with, you know, that's probably the best one. But, you know, again, a lucky guy, you know, all my work with in the very early days, Driven on Channel 4. Then with Fifth Gear, God, I've been so lucky that I've driven pretty much most cars. And over the years, God, I've had to go in some really special, really special.
What about looking? I know you're not looking at what's going on at the moment in terms of touring cars because you're focused on something else, but you will be going back to it. You know, you look at the phenomenal success of Lewis Hamilton. Is there any other sort of driver out there at the moment, whether it be in touring cars or Formula 3 or in Formula 1, that you go, that's the next Lewis? Or is there anyone that you see actually in touring cars that you go, there's my protege, there's someone coming up that could possibly beat my record?
That's a really interesting question. Well, first off, the Formula 1 guys with Lewis. I mean, you know, we are witnessing in Lewis probably the greatest racing driver that's ever lived, in my opinion.
What about people who say it's the car?
Oh, it is. Yes, he couldn't win without the car, but he is really special. But you could say that about Senna started to win when he got into McLaren. You can say that with Schumacher when he went to Ferrari, started to win. He's created that for himself. Yes, the car is amazing, but let's not forget he's had some quick teammates. But the way he drives, the way he can put a lap together, the way he races, is really very special. But we're very lucky in the UK. You know, I'm a director of the British Racing Drivers Club, who own and operate Silverstone. And there's a big annual award called the, it's basically the BRDC Aston Martin Young Driver of the Year competition, I've been on the judging panel now for about 10 years. And we look at all of UK motorsport and also UK drivers who might be competing abroad, and we pick the best six of those drivers, and they come to Silverstone, and then we put them through 3 days of intensive testing where they all get the same car at the same time, look at their lap times, their you know, not just one lap, but their hysteresis over a race run, look at their fitness, they get to drive all different sorts of cars, and we pick one winner. And over the years, the standouts so far, who when the competition was on, even day one, you go, Jesus Christ, that kid's good. The standouts are Lando Norris, who won it 4 years ago, and George Russell. And actually, although I won't mention because he's not going to come through just yet, but last year's winner is really special. But Lando, God, that boy's good, you know. And he's got a great personality. He's fun. He's very focused. He's a brilliant racer. He could be really special. So we're lucky in the UK. We've got some brilliant talents in touring cars. You know, there's a guy who I mentioned before, Ash Sutton, who was precocious teammate of mine who kind of blew me away, but didn't really. His style in the car is very similar to my early days. But can he go on to become one of the greats? I'm not sure, because I don't think he's commercially astute enough.
And you're not being Dick Dastardly here at all.
No, not at all. But do you know what? I think to have a long career in touring cars, you need to be pretty smart and cute and businesslike, and you need to be able to put different hats on. And whilst he can drive a car really great, and there's no disputing that, I don't think he's got these other elements you need to become a true great touring car champion.
I look forward to his response to that. What about you? What about you in civvy life? When you're not on a racetrack, you're in a car, do people ever try and take you on?
Yeah.
Do they really?
Yeah.
What happens?
Do you know what? It's normally at, say, you're in a queue coming to a roundabout on an A road or something like that, or some traffic lights, and there'll be a car with a loud exhaust or whatnot next to you. And obviously they're into cars. I generally drive nice cars. They'll clock the car, then clock me, because they probably see me on TV or stuff. And every now and then they come on, let's you know, they they want to have a go. And most times I just am not in the mood. But there have been a couple of occasions when some very humorous things have happened. In fact, not far from you, you know, bottom of the 408 at the M4.
Yeah.
That is it. Imagine you're coming up the M4 heading west and you want to turn off towards Marlow.
Yeah.
And you get to the traffic lights at the top where you then join that big roundabout, which is like an oval, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, mate, is that how you remember your races? Because you can remember motorways. You can remember, do you actually remember? And the cat's eyes are at that point only 1 meter and 3 centimeters apart. But carry on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have a photographic memory of these things. Anyway, I was in a Ferrari. And then this which actually wasn't my car, it was a press car. And it was about 8 o'clock at night. And I'd gone that way to go back to Oxford because the M40 was jammed up. Anyway, the lights are on. I'm first at the lights, and there's a guy next to me, and I forget what he's doing. He's seen something like a Nissan GTR with an exhaust pipes that
yeah.
And it's popping and cracking, and he's kind of looked over and he's egged me on. And I thought, all right then, poof, and off I've shot. Well, I've got round the kind of that bit of the oval to go across the top, and he's lost it and put it in the fence. And I've seen him in mid-road. He's literally come out and just thrown it in the Armco. So then I've done another lap.
You've got to go round again.
So just to stop and wind the window down, and just to check he was all right. And he said, mate, you're mental. To me, just because I shot off so quick. And that was a particularly good moment. I did enjoy that.
What about racing people to pay for petrol? Is that part of the competitive Jason Plato that we know and love? So I've heard that apparently you're filling up, he's filling up, you're looking at his dial, he's looking at your dial, the petrol cabs close at the same time,
Yes.
The nozzle goes back into the machine, and then it's a gentle mosey, or is it slightly accelerated?
It's get to the door first, no matter how it looks. Honestly, God, doesn't matter how it looks. If you know, and it's never happened yet, but... You know, it has happened that the person, because they feel the vibe. And
I can see you getting to the door and getting squeezed in.
Yeah, like, they're kind of quickening their step up, but no one's ever gone into a little jog yet. I've gone into a jog, yeah, like a soft jog, just to get to the door. But I do it in supermarkets. If I can see someone, I used to, obviously we don't anymore because we get it delivered because of the bloody virus. But if I wanted to get to that bloke on that till or that lady on that till, I'd make a run for it.
You can swing a trolley around an aisle, basically. You can tell. Mate, what about, look, we're getting close to the end here now. You've got your podcast out. How's that going?
Really great, actually. Really great.
Enjoying it? Enjoy the process?
I've loved it. I mean, I know a lot of the guys and girls anyway. And it's just talking about stuff we love because it's about cars. You know, it's sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance, my long-term sponsor. And the interesting thing is, and I guess let me ask you the question. Have you found that even though I know most of these people and their pals, I've really found out a lot about them by doing a podcast, which ordinarily little gems you don't get to know about. Have you found that?
Absolutely. And also you find that a little bit about yourself as well, because one thing you also work out is that a lot of us, I can't compare my career to yours, very totally different kind of backgrounds, but there's often a lot of things that we do have in common, and laughter is definitely one of them. Talking of that, now, if I tailgated you in a Range Rover and then came beside me, would you give me the finger?
Yeah. And I know where this is going, and it is a gem of a story. And I mean, I still get that slightly clammy feeling. Just
what were you in? You're going up the M4. You're driving a what?
I was in my Renault Laguna V6 off on another Renault event.
Yeah, right.
And it was early morning. It was on a Sunday. The roads were empty, and I'm doing 85, 90. Not flat out, just trying making progress because the roads are quiet. Anyway, I come across some guy, you know, overtaking the lorry in the outside lane, and he's doing like 70. So I'm like, and I'm waiting patiently. And the next thing is a big Range Rover giving it the big flash behind. And I'm like, oh, mate, no, no, no. I look, I'm
stuck as well.
I'm stuck, yeah. Just wait. And he's right on me. And he's giving it the big flash. And I wasn't having that. So he got the big middle pedal brake test. And he backs right off. Me and I thought, right, that's you sorted. Great. So then I'm like, I've pulled in and I've timed it in my head so that when as it's come alongside, I've then looked over and given it the big, have that, only to see Prince Charles is in the passenger seat. And his face went from kind of like looking at me going to, ooh.
Don't see that every day.
No. And then the Outriders, oh, I'm on the hard shoulder, pulled out the car on the hands down on the bonnet, being given a massive bollocking. But I got away with it.
Got away with it. And you're still getting away with it. That's the whole point. You see, yeah, you're still getting away with it.
But interestingly enough, I met Charles at Silverstone at one of the British Grand Prix and did ask him if he remembered that. And he said, yes, he did.
Yes. Because I know it happens to him every day. Jason, I think last question. I mean, you know, as you say, it's sort of on hold for you at the moment until next season. But as you say, there is possibly an end to it, but it's not in sight for you. And I don't think it's in your nature to ever give in, is it?
No. No, it's not. No, it's not. But, you know, when the time is right, it won't be me giving in. It'll be me deciding, do you know what? I'm done now. I'm on to other things. But, you know, the thought of that seems so far away to where I am mentally at the moment.
But would you think it would be in racing, or would it be something completely different?
I honestly don't know, actually. I mean, at the moment, I struggle if I'm racing or you know, I struggle to go to a racetrack unless I'm there to race. I don't like it. I don't like to be at racetracks and not be doing something. So, you know, a lot of people said, well, what about going to the team ownership or team management? And the, you know, my standard answer is I can't imagine anything worse. Thanks. But when I decide racing stopped, then actually that might well change. Actually, that mindset might change. But I do, you know, a few years ago, I ran a bursary program for young up and coming drivers. And in fact, we had some of the guys on the program who have a few years later became a right pain in the ass on the track. A guy like Tom Ingram, who, you know, me, we've had some great races. But I really quite enjoy that, actually. I quite like the mentoring process. I quite like, you know, so maybe managing a driver or two, that could become interesting. I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, I've got a marketing company, you know, might get more involved in that.
But while you're racing, that's what you're doing. You're racing until that changes, Jason. Thank you very, very much.
No, yeah, pleasure. Pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancer Collective production. Thanks to the team and One Fine Play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.